Hey everybody, it is time. It is time to hop on a plane, a train, a boat, a goat, a bike, a car, and find your way upstate New York to a little town outside of Phoenicia. I don't know what the town's called actually, but the place that we're going to be in is called Menla, and it is a gorgeous, epic retreat center in the middle of the forest in the Catskill Mountains with a spa and organic vegetarian food with lots of beans and yoga in the morning and a swimming pool and a swimming hole and trails. And yes, it is an HLN retreat. It is a 5-day retreat from Wednesday, June 12th to Sunday, June 16th. It is the biggest retreat we've ever put on, and the entire team is going to be there. They are all flying from different corners of the country to come together to hold you in the healing magic that is Somatics. We will be teaching you how to belong without having to fit in, how to find safety inside of yourself and share that with others, how to receive witnessing, how to feel for your boundaries instead of fawning. We are going to cover so much, and you're going to be doing it in the most ideal setting of being fed, of being loved, of resting, of enjoying the forest and nature, and being with us and 60 other bodies. So please go to the website, holisticlifenavigation.com, and click on events, and you'll find it there. Wednesday, June 12th to Sunday, June 16th. All the info as well can be found directly through the link in this episode details. I am just so thrilled for this, and I can't wait to see some of you in person. On today's episode, I have a conversation with my colleagues about co-regulation, which is the experience of attuning to another person's body and feeling safe.
Being comfortable in your own skin and having tools that help you relax is a really big deal, but learning how to feel safe with others is revolutionary.
Welcome to the Holistic Life Navigation Podcast. I'm your host, Luis Mujica. I was sick and depressed until I discovered that I could make music, and then my whole life transformed. Because I began learning how to listen more deeply. Listen to life, to the people around me, and to my body. And that's when I realized that the body speaks through sensations, and learning this new language meant relearning my body and mind. I soon healed myself of many chronic conditions, and then began teaching others how to do so as well. Holistic Life Navigation combines nutrition, self-inquiry, and somatic experiencing to help you release stress and trauma just by listening to your own body. This podcast serves as a place to share my experiences, as well as the experiences of many others who have healed and are healing through unique, unorthodox, and unusual ways. Your time to learn begins now. Co-regulation is the foundation of my work. I talk a lot about self-regulation because my hope and wish for everybody is that they have enough safety in their own bodies that they can regulate, ground, and find comfort in themselves when they're in emergency situations or when they're isolated or when they're alone or when they're hurting and there's no one around them that can help. Self-regulation is the experience of finding safety in yourself, and it's the ultimate in self-confidence because you always have what you need to access yourself and to ground and feel held by you. So addictions are not necessary. Coping mechanisms are not necessary. Codependent relationships are not necessary. All these addictive behaviors will just essentially dissipate and disappear when there's self-regulation, because you have everything you need to meet your needs. But how do we get self-regulation? We get it through co-regulation. Co-regulation is the experience of another being creating safety in your body. a better way to even say that. My body sees yours and it starts to ground and come down. You see me, and when you look at me, my body comes down and I feel grounded and safe. You know, the first co-regulator is the mother. You're in the womb and you're rocked and bathed in her womb and you're co-regulating within the body. And then you're born and then you get the breast or the bottle and you're co-regulating again. Someone's holding it up to your mouth. Someone's carrying you. Someone's cuddling you. It's the earliest experiences of finding safety in another person. So our ability to self-regulate comes from many years of development in childhood, in infancy, in young adulthood, teenage years, all the different stages until we become adults, whatever that means. And what essentially is happening is you're consistently and predictably feeling safe and seen and held and got by the people around you. Now, how many of you listening have that experience? You might have the experience of lots of love, but not lots of connection, which seems weird, right? Because we think, well, if someone loves me, we should connect, but not necessarily. I've had a lot of clients tell me how loved they were, how cared for they were, how well their needs were met. However, they never really felt seen. They never really felt held. They never really emotionally felt safe with their parents or their family. And this is to no fault of the parents or guardians, because sometimes they are dysregulated and traumatized themselves and can't give it. Other times they've given exactly what they could, the best they could, and it wasn't enough. And it not being enough isn't a judgment on them or the child. It just wasn't what the child needed. So when we have these ruptures in our relationships with parents, or we have what's called early attachment wounding, which just means the way I securely attached to my parent was compromised. It could be as aggressive as abuse, or it could be as covert, again, as someone not being able to make eye contact, of a parent being away a lot, so you were alone in your body often, having lots of different nannies, or being in school really early. There's so many situations that don't come from abuse or any kind of overt assault or aggression that can still create what's called a misattunement, right? Where you're just missing one another's energy. And when you grow up like that, you tend to not trust co-regulation. So you auto-regulate. You do things in isolation to create safety. And at a really young age, those things are usually eating, watching TV, watching pornography, eating lots of sugar, especially when we're talking about eating. They can develop into sexual codependent relationships. They can develop into drug addictions, into alcoholism. There are many different ways we, when we're alone, create safety at a young age that morphs into coping behaviors and addictions. And then there's the simple experiences as well without addiction or coping mechanisms. Well, without addictions, where we bring in a coping mechanism that might be agoraphobia. It might be, I'm afraid to leave the house. It doesn't feel safe outside of what I can control. That's an extreme example. Another one is when we call the introvert or the empath or the highly sensitive person. Someone that doesn't have a lot of safety in groups or even one-on-one. And what we're doing in this episode is shedding some light on what co-regulation is, what happens when you don't get it, and how to actually rebuild it so that you can self-regulate and create safety with the people around you. All right, welcome everybody. Alexis Katz.
So I'm Alexis. I am a clinical social worker in private practice in Saratoga Springs, New York. And I have just finished my formal training in somatic experiencing. So I'm really launching headfirst into getting the thumbs up from my cohort here into as much somatic work as I can these days. Thanks for having me on.
Danny Shidlowski.
Hey, everyone. Danny Shidlowski, clinical social worker specializing in somatic experiencing, recently relocated to Kingston, New York, and excited to be here. Thanks.
And Laurie Robbins.
So I am also a clinical social worker. I have a private practice in Summit, New Jersey. I am in my advanced year of somatic experiencing training. And I also am an EMDR practitioner and primarily treat complex trauma. I look forward to the discussion.
I wanted to start by just kind of opening up the forum to talk about co-regulation and how we experience it, how we like to explain it. And Alexis had this great line from a book that I wanted her to read first. So if you don't mind, Alexis.
No, I'd love to. This is from The Power of Attachment, How to Create Deep and Lasting Intimate Relationships. It's by Diane Poole Heller, PhD, who's I just checked this. She isn't actually faculty at Somatic Experiencing. I know she hosts a lot of trainings and has written this really interesting book, primarily about attachment, but an undercurrent to that is clearly co-regulation. And this isn't a paragraph where she's talking about the importance of both self-regulation and co-regulation. And she's given examples about how a lot of us self-regulate through yoga and other kinds of relaxation or meditation, and emphasizing, you know, those are important. And then she says, being comfortable in your own skin and having tools that help you relax is a really big deal, but learning how to feel safe with others is revolutionary. And I really thought that says a lot about the importance of co-regulation.
Yeah, I just want all of us to soak that in. I think it's really profound. And just, you know, I'm curious what might bubble up for all of us when we hear that. Is there anything we want to add to that experience of co-regulation or just to the line Alexis shared?
Well, I think one of the things that comes up for me when I hear that actually really eloquent statement is that, you know, prior to safe attachment is co-regulation. And it's one of the things that happens in infancy, or it does or it doesn't, right? And so if we think about, you know, thinking more about polyvagal theory and Stephen Porges's idea of co-regulation creating a physiological platform of safety that provides a sense of security for us. So I also, you know, I think a lot about my clients who have had complex trauma, and when a safe attachment with an adult figure doesn't happen, just how it sets the stage for some really troubling things in people's life, as well as my idea of, and obviously the understanding of neuroplasticity and our ability to develop those neural networks throughout our lives. So it's just a lovely opportunity for us as therapists to provide a corrective experience when early misattunement, chronic misattunement, unsafe experiences of regulating, dysregulated caregivers. That is more of the story for a lot of my clients with complex trauma. So that's what comes up for me. And I'm eager to talk with all of you more about it tonight.
I just wanted to highlight a term you used. You said like physiological platform. And I think that's a really beautiful way to put it for people listening, because co-regulation isn't just about what's being exchanged intellectually. Because anyone hearing this for the first time may be thinking of just, you know, community or communication. But it's really about the physiological platform of my body feels safe and regulated with this being. And the word that always comes in for me, I don't know about all of you, but the word predictably always comes in. Like, did I have predictable, consistent safety with this human being in infancy and in childhood and during that development? Because what that literally means is you're developing with your blood pressure neutral, your heartbeat is calm, your eyes are calm, you're not in a state of hypervigilance, you feel open and expansive, you have a physiological development in response to another body. And I think it's just really powerful for people to really get what that means when you said that. So if you want to add anything else to what I just said or in response, I would love that. Otherwise, anyone can jump in.
Well, I like the idea as you're talking about the, you know, the early developing autonomic nervous system. You know, the biological imperative for it to be a safe nervous system for us to then develop safety in co-regulation, right? And up until I think it's about 18 months of age, I don't know if anybody knows the exact develop milestone on this, but I think it's around 18 months of age, we're solely Our nervous systems are solely looking to others to regulate us. And so it just is so profound if we think about the quality of those early, the early relationships, the autonomic experience, and the tone that develops in relation to those adults that raise us, caregivers that raise us.
You know, it you just provoked another thought for me about. Yeah, I think it is 18 months. I remember I was writing today about this, and I remember as I was writing, I got the idea. I was like, wow, but you know, people in their 60s are still doing that. You know, it's like we have this idea that it's like through the childhood years and infancy and these early stages of development, that's when we'll get it and then we can self-regulate. But we're still learning how to self-regulate middle age. So I'm also, and maybe this is for later, but I had this idea today that self-regulation is a lifelong practice. You don't reach it. It's not like that idea of like you reach nirvana and now you're solid. I think it's like a constant practice of building trust. But those early years or early months of the physiological platform of trust is like this well of resourcing that we then use as we go forward. I think that's something I'm interested in just exploring.
Sure.
We could come back to also talking about how, you know, you mentioned that you threw in the word consistent before.
Predictable.
And that obviously has a lot to do with trust. And we can, you know, if we talk more about just clinically later, how many patients each of us has probably had who had very, you know, very loving parent, but maybe the parent was alcoholic or had mental illness or something like that, that caused them to really only be able to co-regulate with them sporadically. Or if anything, just inconsistently, and how much of, you know, it sets them up for so much of a, like kind of a life's work of repairing that.
I mean, you just said something important, which was even if you have a loving parent, because I know we've all experienced so many people that have really great childhoods, like for the most part, like no major abuse has ever occurred, no major traumatic event. However, there's a major social anxiety or there's a distrust or there's the inability to regulate, or choosing people who are really dysregulated because you're familiar with that. So you can have a lot of love, and the parent who is loving could also have sporadic moments of not being around or being really depressed. You know, they don't have to be aggressive. They can also be depressed, and you can feel neglected by their depression and distanced from it even. So I think that's an important key to highlight, that even if there's love and kindness and great intentions, that dysregulation can still occur, which can rupture the relationship a bit. Does anyone want to add to that? I think that's an important point that Alexis made.
Well, I would say around the intention piece, especially that, you know, at least, you know, Laurie mentioned, you know, polyvagal theory and Stephen Porges, that our shifts into protection mode, and like when we go into protection mode, that's when our social engagement system, you know, stops functioning, or at least reduces. Sorry, I just lost my train of thought for a second.
Just stay with it. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting.
I mean, I'm just hearing when you say shift into polyvagal, like which?
Oh, I'm sorry. Activation. Yeah. So it's that it's not a conscious choice generally when that happens, that there's this, you know, what Stephen Porges calls neuroception, that it's our autonomic nervous system that kind of makes that choice, and we become consciously aware of it after it's already happened, or after the shift has already happened.
You're talking about widening the lens of the parent who's dysregulated. So you're saying right now, okay, that's important. Yeah, I like that.
But also for I mean, well, we might get more into this later, but just in general, for people who struggle with being able to access that, or when it feels like other people are unreachable, or you yourself feel unreachable. And if there's judgment on top of that, like what's wrong with me, or, you know, that it's a state that one has shifted into, that's not a conscious choice. Once you realize it, okay, then there can be some more choices to make. But, you know, just in terms of that like example you gave of the parent, it's just something to keep in mind.
I think that's a really compassionate, and not just compassionate, but like realistic viewpoint for everyone listening, because we are talking about co-regulation through the lens of somatic therapy. So we're talking about the unconscious, essentially, and how it shows up physically and how it shows up in our behaviors. So when you said about intention, that's so important, because someone can think, oh my God, I was always there for my kids, but they might not know what their body's doing, right? And the children are picking up on that. And as adults, we think like, oh, I have this great life. I don't know why I'm so upset. We're talking about what's beneath the surface, what's in the body versus what's in your conscious mind. So I think just that piece is super important to go into a little more. I wonder if Alexis or Lori has anything they want to say to that, or anything that provokes, even if it's not a direct response.
Yeah, I guess it does make me think about the profound role that we can play, the incredibly influential role that we can play as therapists, providing that corrective experience even through education, right? So this piece of this beautiful dialogue that we're having right now to use as a way in to explain to folks who really come in, very, very often coming into the office, right? Saying, my parents loved me. They took very good care of me. I grew up in a upper middle class family. And there's so many, I don't know, we could use the word defenses, but there's a lot of reasons why clients are protective of that story, that narrative, right? But then to provide a little bit of education about this, the ways in which chronic misattunement, empathic failures, the little t traumas that really are embedded in one of these concepts we're talking about here, right, is co-regulation and safe attachment, really can set the stage for the way in which people just feel safe in the world, feel safe in their own bodies, but feel safe in the world. And I often find, I don't know about all of you, but I often find that there's a, you can even see it in the physiology, when there's just a touch of education about this kind of thing, right? Polyvagal theory or, right, a relaxing or a letting go or a curiosity, an openness then to another story other than life was great. I was really loved, right? And then there's the possible way into really helping somebody understand the pieces of their past that are going to be helpful to focus on in terms of treatment planning.
I think I love that because especially the piece where you said about just when you're just talking about the education and you think of like a client walking in that's saying, well, I grew up middle class and I had all my needs met. One thing I love, and just for people listening to this, it's not the goal here, what Lori's saying, the goal isn't to say, no, your life was shit. The goal is to say, wait, you don't have to have shame for feeling anxious. Because when that defense comes up that says, everything was fine, what do you mean? That defense also says to the person, what's wrong with me that I feel so misattuned? What's wrong with me that I can't connect? What's wrong with me that I can't get out of bed? When everything, people have it so much worse, right? We always hear that, well, I have no reason to be upset. I had it easy. I think to get into these little T traumas, these covert situations where there's a rupture or a misattunement, and that was very familiar for all of us growing up, so we wouldn't even know that it was a rupture or misattunement. It validates what the nervous system is doing. And to bring in what Danny said, it doesn't shame the parents. It's not about saying your parents were wrong. It's about saying this is what happened in their body and this is how your body responded. And we can regenerate and you know, recover that. That's very empowering, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I found, I think it was almost a decade ago, I read the book, Mindsight by Dan Siegel. Have any of you guys read that? I haven't read it again since then, and I should, because I tend to refer to it a lot when I'm providing like information for clients. And it's a piece that I think people find really helpful. I remember him talking about, to follow up on what both of you just talked about, that often even in a, you know, almost good enough attachment that a small child will have with their parent, if that small child's not really getting their emotional needs met, or they don't feel completely safe, let's say that parent is somewhat depressed or distracted by other children or something consistently, that they're That burden of need, the child ends up internalizing as their own burden. So they feel like, and of course he wrote about it really eloquently. I wish I could quote him, that because I'm not getting my needs met, I'm doing something wrong. And this is like the one-year-old is thinking this, right? Obviously not in those words, but having a sense, a felt experience of it's because of how I am that my needs aren't getting met. It's because of how I am that I'm not able to co-regulate and feel soothed. Combining that with what we were talking about earlier with how essential co-regulation is for very small children. And so then that little kid grows up to an adult that feels that excess in burden for when they aren't able to co-regulate with another person, even like a shopkeeper or something like that, like somebody that's a stranger to them, they feel misattuned with that person. They will walk away from that experience feeling shame or feeling as if there's something wrong with them. And it's a felt experience. I think that's really something that's in the body, and it's something that becomes like an internalized threat. So this goes back to then the body is responding with to that as a threat response.
I really love that. And I'm glad you said the word shame, because when you were talking about, let's say, like a one-year-old, and they're feeling a dysregulation in the field between them and their guardian or their parent, it's like the physiology of that is shame. And then as you're developing, that physiology turns into concepts and identity, right? Like, I'm worthless versus my body feels like something's worthless. And, you know, such a difference there in the language. But if we're developing for many years with that dynamic, even in a loving household, we still grow up with that identity that says I'm worthless eventually, right? And I think that's important. And I'm about to go to Lori, but I just want to ask you, Alexis, just to kind of fill people in who are listening and don't know the terminology, can you just share misattunement, you know, what that means in our world or to you?
Yeah, I mean, it's something I end up talking about a lot. And with certain clients that I've worked with, it's super meaningful. Once it's another one of those concepts that once they get it, it feels really helpful. So I think attunement is when you feel really seen, when you feel really gotten by somebody, you have really good attunement with them. Misattunement is when there's the opposite experience. And I'm gesturing with my hands, sweeping them past each other, like they're missing each other. I realize now I do that every time I say the word misattunement. It's two objects flying by each other and just not connecting. And for some people, that's really painful. So even if it's not an important relationship, if the other person is irritable or something else could be going on with that person, they don't connect. They express some sort of negativity or just a lack of connection, maybe no eye contact. The person who's sensitive to misattunement can feel really harmed by that, or that can be a painful experience for them.
That's helpful, because I see misattunement, as we're talking about it somatically, very similar to what we call like microaggressions, and even, you know, like covert racism or covert narcissism or covert sexism, these things that are just kind of like affecting the person's body and they might not even consciously know it's happening, or they feel it or they don't know why they feel it. I think it's a great way to explain it. And it makes me think of just nature. And I think the reason why misattunement is so traumatizing to a really young body is, you know, if we think primitively just for survival, if there isn't attunement, you're not even being seen. So what could happen to your body, right? So if we think of, you know, way before we were still in the chaos, the beautiful chaos of nature in the natural world, where there are many more threats looming, a child's nervous system, that little body, that attunement, just created the safety around, I can survive because I'm being held and seen. And so I also wonder, you know, how far back that goes in our development as a species even.
As Alexis was talking about Dan Siegel and some of his work and his research I think he's considered an interpersonal neurobiologist. I think that's what his title is. It also just makes me think it's a beautiful fit with SE. In terms of the concept that Peter Levine coined of Cyban, right? Because if we think about what we do as a culture, is we have highly, highly developed meaning around things because we're really, you know, organized, intelligent, reliant upon our thought processes. But when it comes to this perception of safety that our bodies are wired to sense into, right? With neuroception, right? We have that felt sense of whether something is safe, and it's based on our earlier life experience. We respond in relation to how we were treated. We develop our felt sense of safety with others in relation to how, in relationship to how we were treated. So as SC practitioners, I just always think it gives us lots of opportunities to help clients identify where meaning can get in the way of really sensing into what is in the physiology.
And you're saying lose the meaning and feel the physiology.
Yes, which I don't know about the rest of you and your day-to-day practices, but I find that it's one of the hardest things, one of the biggest challenges in SE sessions, particularly with folks who relied on intellectualization as their psychological defense to get through, right? If I understand, then I feel better, is bottom-up processing, right? And what we learned in SE is helping folks redirect to the body and to see how we can maybe make sense of it and help them experience some of their story in a different way, more working with the somatic experience.
I'm glad you said that. And you know, even when you say, just for people listening, when you say SE, you know, what Laurie's referring to is somatic experiencing, which is what we were trained in, it's a form of somatic therapy. And you know, what she's saying is when you, for some of us, meaning is the means of safety. It's how we try to auto-regulate. We try to create a container that has organized our experiences, because the vulnerability and the physicality of them is so overwhelming still. So we create the story or the meaning or the identity, whatever around it, it gets us through. Yet, I find, just like you said, with my clients, when they let go of the meaning, they're met with a charge initially because it's terrifying to drop the identity. But then that charge brings up all the physiological information that we're looking for. Like all the emotions, any repressed memory, the physical needs of a boundary, words that they didn't even know they were holding in. So when the meaning drops, this really organic living thing comes through, which is really magical. It's one thing I love so much about SE. I'm glad you said that. Danny, did you want to add?
Yeah, to add that Deb Dana, who writes about polyvagal theory, you know, always writes that story follows state. And so that like a little, this is a little different, I think, of a take than what you were just saying. No, I agree with what you were just saying. But that it's like, it's so helpful. I found with people and even personally, of course, that you, when you're stuck in a narrative, you don't really realize that you're, because we don't get any education around this, of course, as when we're growing up, but that your physiological state is creating the story, that in certain physiological states, only certain stories are going to be created by our minds. So in a shutdown state, it's, you know, it's that shame. It's I'm hopeless. I'm unreachable. Other people are unreachable. And of course, like threatening. And then in a more kind of fight flight state, there's more of that kind of vigilant threat. But so that's what gets, what I found is super helpful, because if the story is a story of hopelessness, I found at least with, like, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy type interventions of trying to challenge the thoughts, I don't know, when the physiological state is intensely shut down, I don't know. I've actually found sometimes that it actually increases the shame, because it's like, oh, this thing isn't working. I'm trying this, you know, counter thought and it's not working. And of course, because physiologically you're not able to make that certain meaning and to challenge the hopelessness. And that's where, again, yeah, like Laurie said, the somatic experiencing can be so helpful and empowering, because then it becomes about, oh, right. I know that when I'm in this state, that's when all these stories about my past and my future and the hope, or everyone being a danger and me having to fight, you know, whatever it is. And then also realizing, oh, in certain states, I feel like I suddenly want to reach out to someone, or I want to do this creative thing, or what. And so to start to track the states becomes so important.
I love that. I, even to wrap that around to co-regulation, is so important, right? Because when we're in an office with somebody or ourselves or anybody, let's say we're with a client and they're feeling that state of worthlessness. And the mind, let's say the mind is saying, I feel worthless right now. And then once they can embody what worthlessness feels, let's say they say, I just want to curl over. Like we all see that physiological shame response of curling inward. And so what I've done many times with clients, I'll have them put a pillow there. Instead of curling, I'll ask them to put a pillow there. So they get to feel their spine straight even when it wants to curl, but then they have the pillow, so they have a boundary. And then go back to what Alexis was saying, they get to attune to me. And they get to attune to the plants in the room. They get to attune to the breath they're taking in. And that feeling, the physiological response of wanting to curl, gets really lighter and they want to breathe. And then they actually want to be seen. And then in that moment, they lose the identity that says, no one loves me. Or they lose the identity that says, I can't be seen or it's not safe to be seen. And they're like, oh my God, I'm experiencing the thing that my identity says I'm not allowed to experience. And it blows their mind, right? Because the physiological state has shifted. And so the identity follows the new safety state. If anyone wants to add to that, I would love it. Otherwise, I have some other things I'm going to say. Go ahead.
Well, just one quick, very quick thing. One exercise that I've found very useful, especially when people have kind of gone into a really dissociative state, and I actually don't feel comfortable with them, you know, before pandemic leaving my office and now here kind of closing out the session. I've actually taken a pillow and off my couch and we've kind of tossed it back and forth and I'll kind of like change up how, you know, like how high I go and we make it really playful. And it's incredible how quickly people have moved from a very, very dissociative state where I was like, we're not, you know, you're not leaving my office until we are, you know, until I feel more comfortable with this. And it's like within, you know, 2 or 3 minutes of that, I'm like, oh, you know, and like they get like feel a little bouncy maybe. I'm like, oh yeah, okay, I feel like a little bit more here. I can see you. I can, you know, and it's just amazing how that exercise is like that. And you could do it with a ball bouncing. Of course, this is pre-pandemic. But
Well, it's really inspiring because there's the playfulness, which is so beautiful. So it creates just a very good sensation in the body, but there's the attunement because then it's like, I see you, I see the pillow coming. I caught it, I'm throwing, and you, that's lovely. I've never done that before. I'll have to try that. Were you raising your hand, Alexis? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm so glad you just mentioned that, Danny. I feel like I haven't really ever done that with a client and I really want to. I think I've heard that before. Like, I think, I know Peter Levine talks about doing that, but it's a good reminder. I need to try that. Actually, I'm curious if you have any thoughts about how you do that virtually. But it also makes me think about, and Luis, what you were talking about earlier, the fact that really essentially when we're doing somatic experiencing with clients, I've often been really curious about why is this hard to replicate on your own? Like even with all the training and practice I've had, I can't really do it on my own. I have to be at least with a colleague, if not, you know, my own therapist or somebody who, you know, to do it with me. And it's making me realize that it's that co-regulation piece. I guess maybe it's kind of obvious to others, but I had never really thought about it quite so clearly, that it's the co-regulation that's occurring besides the guidance and the expertise, but the co-regulation of having that, witnessing your own somatic experience, witnessing your own sensations and every emotion that comes up in the moment, and having someone with you really curious and witnessing, like total, only paying attention to your experience while it's happening, is extraordinarily co-regulating. And I think one of the reasons, like even when we do those practice sessions and training, even when they're not great, they're still pretty good. Like you still feel pretty good when you walk away. And I think it's just that co-regulation piece.
Which in, when you're saying, when you're saying it goes back to that attunement. Like I see you, I'm witnessing you, I'm reflecting back that you exist in this moment. And something about that's very grounding for you and for all systems, that co-regulation. Go ahead, Laurie, I'd love to hear what you think.
I love the playfulness and talking about how each of you, you know, engage with clients around this idea of co-regulation and a felt sense of safety. Because when you're doing that kind of activity, you're also engaging. I know Peter Levine talks a lot about the muscles of social engagement, the social engagement system, which then engages parasympathetic, ventral vagal nervous system. So whether it's Zoom, like we're all doing now with the pandemic, or in person, if you think about what you are engaging to make sure that you see the pillow coming at you, arms are up, making eye contact, you're using the whole body here to invite your client into a safe space to even be able to lift your arms up and catch the pillow in time and space so that it doesn't hit you. This is the social engagement system that Peter Levine talks about, that we want to have more tone to help us feel safe in our bodies, certainly safe in the therapeutic relationship, safe in the office. It's just such a lovely, lovely example, Danny.
It really is. And I think that that coordination, like you're talking about, it's so embodying. Right? Like you have to enter your body, your own body, to be able to coordinate catching and throwing and feeling that and engaging those physiological systems you're talking about. That really wakes you up to your body. When, you know, when Danny's talking about dissociation, just for everyone listening, he's talking about the phenomenon when we feel a numbness, a disconnect, a fogginess, our consciousness essentially just takes a couple steps back, or for some people, 20 feet back from the body, and you're just not feeling your body. Is too much to feel. So it's so overwhelming, you actually lose the body. So when he says, if someone wants to leave my office and they're so dissociated, I want to get them embodied before they leave, because he's a really good therapist. So there's this game of throwing back the pillow helps the person find their body again. And it creates co-regulation because it's a fun activity with another human that sees you. So it deepens the bond, safety. There's so many beautiful parts of that. It's really inspiring. If you're listening to this and your therapist doesn't do that, please ask them to. So, you know, I want to change the direction a little bit into, because we're talking so much about what co-regulation is. We're talking a lot about misattunement. So everyone listening that's thinking, oh, wow, this makes so much sense why I have social anxiety. It makes so much sense why I have a hard time, you know, trusting people. Makes sense why I'm always really anxious and maybe there's only one person I trust. I don't really believe anyone else can meet my needs. How do we start helping people build that resilience to trust when they've had, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 years experiencing misattunement with other human beings? I'm curious what comes to each of your minds or clinically what you've experienced.
I will say one thing, not specifically about how I do it, but all about polyvagal theory in the last couple of years, and doing the somatic experiencing training. There's an aspect of like the whole 12-step program that suddenly started to realize like what the strength of like that whole setup is, where it's a whole, you know, program set up that no matter what's going on, you stay connected, right? There's a whole thing in 12-step programs around always staying connected, going to meetings, making phone calls. It's this really intense reprogramming of this pattern of isolation, this pattern of completely, you know, going to a substance or behavior, whatever it is, in moments of threat response, and instead kind of pushes you towards, again, that ventral vagal kind of social engagement system, and which is only online when we're feeling safe. So that's not about like my personal practice, but I think it is an interesting 12-step groups get a lot of criticism, some rightfully so, of course, but it is an interesting thing to think about in terms of even how much we focus in our society on individual therapy, right? Like individual one-on-one, let's say.
I'm really glad you said that, because I find that the need for community support and when I think of like tribal circles, you know, in communities, and I think of even pre the nuclear family, like the matriarchal circles around raising kids, where there's like aunts, grandmothers, sisters, older sisters, cousin, there's just such a field of nervous systems to hold each individual. That's so balancing. And we've definitely lost that as a modern society. So to have those circles and those tribes and to make that much more regular and normalize that, I think can help a lot of people outside of individual family therapy, and even outside of just their own individual self-healing practices, because Because like to say what Alexa said in the beginning, it's brilliant to feel safe in your body. It's not even more brilliant, but it's a whole other experience to feel safe with other bodies. You know, it's a whole other experience. Lori, I think you had your hand up.
Yes, I was just responding to that question that you posed about how we help clients. I wasn't sure if you were talking about in the treatment room or just in general, folks who carry, you know, social anxiety or some form of a felt sense of dysregulation as a result of early attachment wounding. And I am thinking first and foremost as a clinician, since this is a group of clinicians all talking here together, of showing up with our own regulated autonomic nervous systems to the treatment relationship, to the therapeutic relationship, and being able to hold that space for clients is so important in helping them be able to build new autonomic patterns in this way with us. And then developing, of course, a new story, hopefully of safety, right? It is safe to be in relationship with others. And I think that we have really an incredible gift as therapists to be able to be in this space to, sometimes for the first time ever for clients, be able to show them another way in arriving as the most regulated presence for someone else.
I appreciate that. There's some piece there you said I wanted to pin. I'm trying to see where it was. The regulated, I'm going to call it the attuner, let's say, you know, the person you're attuning to, or the attuned, however you want to put it, whichever side you're on of it, to show up for people who are dysregulated in their relationships, who have relational trauma, who have early attachment wounding, who have a rupture. So they don't, their body just naturally recoils from another human being, especially one they don't know. To walk into a room one-on-one with a therapist, first of all, is super brave. Just to sit alone with someone for 50 minutes or an hour when you've had so much relational trauma, that alone can either be re-traumatizing or a major breakthrough. But for the therapist to think, and this is, as you're hearing this, my listeners, as you're listening to this, if you're a parent, if you're an employee, whoever you are, whatever your role is where you're around other bodies, this is so applicable to humans. This isn't exclusive to therapists, because it's within our humanity that this somatic experiencing kind of re-educates us how to access. But it's in that natural state of humanity of, wow, when I create safety in here and there's space in here, people feel that and they really feel safe around me. So if you're like a business leader, you know, if you're a teacher, oh my goodness, especially a Zoom teacher, if you're someone that is holding space for a bunch of people or one other person, what a privilege you have in this world. This is not a small thing, even just for 10 minutes. And I don't know about you three, but especially since doing the somatic work, it's changed, it's created such a lens of compassion where if I'm like in a store and someone's in a hurry or they're really aggravated or the cashier's kind of seemingly being rude, I try to do what you just said, where I try to get really quiet and regulated, not attuned to them, so they can attune to me. And there's times where it happens and it's amazing, and we make this bond for 5 minutes. And there's times it doesn't, but it's really fun to notice, like, who am I attuning to? Am I attuning to my safety? Am I attuning to the plants? Am I attuning to this person's anger? Like, we can attune to where we want to, which is really magical too. Please, Lori. And then Alexis.
I was just going to say, it's very kind of you to offer your autonomic nervous system in that way in a grocery store. I have to say for myself, my own capacity in grocery stores these days is not as generous.
I appreciate
it's
that.
It's a great example.
Go ahead, Alexis.
I think that there has to be, I think we all practice this way, but that combination of your own embodiment, so your own as the provider, staying embodied, helping your client learn how to do that, and then continuously also doing little bits of education or naming, you know, recognizing what's happening. So for me, what's been really profound, like even in my own personal experience, it helps me stay more embodied, is even just recognizing that these little tiny experiences of threat response So I have so many thoughts that go into this. I wanted to mention like the idea of shame. And I mentioned to you guys earlier, I really like Brené Brown's definition of shame, which is that it's shame is the fear of disconnection. So I think a lot of everybody's sort of familiar with shame, and a lot of us know what it feels like. And I know that in the world of SE, there's a lot of the posturing. We look at the posturing of shame and all that. But to also be able to recognize it as an experience of fear slash threat has been really helpful for me. So when there's this threat of disconnection, so I, even in a grocery store experience like that, if I wanted to do what you're describing, my knee-jerk reaction is going to be to respond to that irritable cashier as sort of like maybe as a threat. But I think prior to doing somatic experiencing work myself, I would get less embodied. I'd stay in my head and be judgmental or go into that defensive threat response mode. But if I can go into my body and realize, oh, I feel like I'm bracing or I'm tightening up here, my chest just got really tight, I feel kind of threatened by that person's irritability, because I think, like Laura, I'm not going to be automatically quite as generous as you're describing, like, with being able to just give them the benefit of the doubt. But I can get there. And so I've never actually done this in a grocery store, to be clear. But if I wanted to, I'd have to go through all these steps, right? That initial response would be recognizing that I was feeling threat, maybe even shame starting to form because there's no attunement, right? There's no attunement. There's no co-regulation occurring. I might start to feel like there's something I'm doing wrong. But recognizing all of this from an embodied perspective and recognizing for me, it would manifest probably in like a tightening in my limbs or in my core. And then the cool thing about somatic experiencing, as soon as we recognize that, we often are able to kind of start to release it pretty quickly, especially when it's sort of in a minor or less urgent scenario. And then I can be more embodied and calm. And then, I don't know, maybe I'll experiment and see if I can get strangers to co-regulate with me. I have not tried that yet, but I love the idea. That's what I would have to do to get there. And that's what I feel like somatic work helps us do.
I just love that little journey you took us on in your own self-inquiry, because that's like the gift of this work, right? It's something that, it's not like, when I said earlier, self-regulation is a lifetime practice, I really believe that. And I believe the trust of co-regulation is also a lifetime practice. If you have a lot of co-regulation in your past that felt really safe, again, people listening, just means I felt safe with this body, or this body saw me and that made me feel safe. If you have a lot of co-regulation in your history and development, of course, it's going to be easier for you to trust it because you have this, you know, history physically and mentally that says, oh, when this happens, it feels good. It's an association. But what's so good about this work is if you don't have that, what you learn in this work is that somatic self-inquiry is what I like to call it, where you're able to say, oh my gosh, the cashier won't make eye contact with me. And instead of my mind tearing her apart, you know, like a little defense mechanism or tearing myself apart, I inquire to see what's going on in my body. And I notice, oh, my chest gets tight. Oh, I start turning away from her. My voice gets monotone. We learn the way that our bodies in like a split second respond to shame, the fear of being disconnected or being othered or being canceled, you know, wherever we go with that, where the fear is coming from. But it's just a powerful mechanism to learn, because this is where it gets kind of existential or spiritual. But for me, I talked to Dave Berger about this on I think it's episode 9, how there's like this consciousness, you know, this who the I is, and some people will call it spirit or soul, but there's many different names for it, energy. And then there's the body that you're inhabiting, right? And this body is so programmed, but it's not who you are. So it's this thing we get to love and use and experience, but without that somatic self-inquiry, you believe it's who you are unconsciously. So when the chest gets tight and the shoulders hunch because the cashier doesn't make eye contact with me, I believe unconsciously that's who I am. I am this hunch. I am this shame. I am this rupture. But somatic experiencing gives you a little space between your consciousness and your physiology. And we don't really ever talk about it like that, but I think it's brilliant. I wonder if you three experience it that way, but I totally experience it that way. And when you just walked us through your own process, that's how I experienced it as well. And that's what made me think of it that way. Is that, do you hear that, what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Yeah, go ahead.
And I think what's interesting to flip that scene and think about the cashier in that case who, you know, might be not making eye contact with anybody. So it's, I love that, just to imagine the scenario, and we've each now walked through, like, if we're in the, you know, the role of approaching that cashier, but then put yourself in the shoes of that cashier and think about, this person may not be making eye contact with anybody that day or whatever's going on with them. So then all of that identification is forming for them. And they're not having the opportunity to, so it's a habit or whatever, to not make the eye contact. They're not having, this is the important part, they're not having the opportunity to co-regulate. So they're existing throughout their whole shift in the store, whatever, if they don't make eye contact or they don't form any kind of connection, they're not co-regulating throughout their entire shift, yet passing by all these bodies, right? All these bodies interacting with them and not co-regulating. I mean, so it's one thing if you're working on your own somewhere in an office or whatever, but they're having all these interactions with no co-regulation and thinking about how harmful that is for them, that's a really potentially stuck and difficult place for them to be.
And that's so compassionate, right? Like, for you to say that. And just for everyone listening, I mean, the pandemic, the racial injustice, which has always existed, but because of cell phones, now we're all seeing it. It's like there's so much we're being bombarded with in our nervous systems right now that the need for co-regulation, even for a minute with a cashier, could like save a life. I mean, really, it could change the person's entire system. And I don't mean that in like a savior complex. I just mean that as like a fellow human. You know, like when Alexis just said that, I was imagining myself as a woman, because I saw a cashier who actually did this to me. So I was thinking of her. And I was just seeing myself there on my feet for 8 hours, a big plastic thing in front of me, a mask, gloves, scared people, everyone's trying to maintain distance. And I don't make eye contact for 8 hours. I almost want to cry now when I just think of how lonely that must feel. So that's, thank you for that. It's really powerful. Go ahead, Lori.
Yes, just adding to this, this scene and this discussion about the grocery store and the cashier, that I love what Deb Dana says in relation to situations like this. I believe she says something like this: no matter how crazy the behavior looks, that if we all have a perspective of understanding that this behavior is a survival response, that system, that cashier system, the person who's, you know, maybe they're loud in the grocery store towards their kids or whatever it is, frightening, that it's all in the service of survival. And knowing that really does allow us to come from a much more compassionate place.
I really appreciate that. Right. And I agree 100%. It's really beautiful. And I just want to add to that, because I say that stuff a lot, not that exactly, but I say things like that a lot. And I, once in a while, I'll find the person that gets very triggered by it because they think I'm condoning, you know, violence. And I think, you know, what you said is true, and it's not condoning violence. Anyone listening to this has to read My Grandmother's Hands. It's a book from Resma Menachem. And there's so many chapters, but there's one chapter that really comes up right now when you're talking about this. I think it's called Police Brutality. And one's called like Violation of the Black Body. And he's essentially talking about, and he's using the police, and he's using white police specifically on black people of color in America. And he's just saying on both sides, you're getting a survival response, whether it's the civilian shooting back at the cop or the cop shooting at the civilian. It's a, in that moment, he neutralizes the playing field. And he says, listen, at the end of the day, it's a survival mechanism. Doesn't condone it, you know, it's violent. But to understand the root of it is how we actually start to shift and transmute it and transform it, so we don't keep passing it down and creating these social structures. So I'm really glad you said that. I think Danny was next, and I'm going to go to Alexis.
Well, I'm not going to share what I was going to share before, because we've shifted a little bit, but actually just a quick comment on what you just said. It's interesting because we can only really be in a space to understand the nuance of, you know, that trying to understand something isn't to condone it, when we are feeling safe and regulated inside. So it's just kind of funny.
Thank you. No, I think that's so brilliant. I think that's so brilliant. I'm sure we've all felt that, like when we're in a session with a client, someone that has like the people I deal with, especially like fawners, people that fawn a lot. And then when they can be honest, they're like viciously aggressive and rageful and violent, like in their fantasies. And once they get to that place of safety, I can bring up the person or situation that caused violence and there's no violence. They get what happened. And even if it's an abusive person, they get the clarity that says, I just have to leave. Like, that's my answer. And it's so brilliant. So you saying that you have to be in the safety to feel the compassion, so spot on. Alexis.
Yeah, well, and just about my grandmother's hands, I've literally just been reading that over the past few days. And what I really love how he weaves in the history of the United States in such a way that, and other recent books about race and racism in America have also written about this or spoken about this really eloquently, but he helps us to really see how essential it was for the construction of slavery that white people not see Black people as human. And therefore there's this, you know, really deep gap in the potential for any co-regulation between them, allowing them therefore to be completely brutal, allowing white people to be completely brutal to Black people. And then looking at how that sort of continues. I don't even know if he really speaks directly about co-regulation, but I feel like it's sort of intrinsically a part of a lot of the message that's there. So then the trauma that lives on in all bodies in America, you know, is perpetuated by the lack of sort of just feeling that rigidity and not being willing to see the other as human enough to reach that point of compassion and to co-regulate. You know, that's probably really where the healing is.
And when you said that, you know, what I was hearing was my reference earlier when I was saying microaggression and how like a microaggression or a misattunement could be the second you look at the cashier. And it can be, you know, I can be a white passing man looking at a white passing or white cashier. And in that moment, there could be a microaggression of I'm judging her as less than me because she won't make eye contact. Like, to me, it gets that detailed and unspoken of othering somebody. And so when you're saying that piece about the co-regulation around racism in our country, I mean, absolutely. And it's like what Danny was saying, without the self-regulation of feeling safety, and this goes to what we're all saying, you need the safety in your body to have anything to even share with a body that feels unsafe, right? So it's that constant rebuilding of that store of safety in us. And then when we go into the world consciously and we see someone that's unsafe or they're yelling or we feel it off of them, we can touch into our safety even a little bit and it can bring the field down just ever so slightly. And so I think what you're saying about co-regulation around even the people that we other, I mean, so important. And what I love about it, it goes beyond politics and even cultural beliefs and identity, and it goes right down to the body. It's like if my body feels safe and yours feels unsafe, without talking or agreeing with you, we can actually feel safe together if we can just feel that. You know, and that's what's really beautiful about it for me. I think that's important. How are we feeling? You know, we're going to close soon. Are there any thoughts, any closing thoughts, anything anybody wants to throw out, even if it's unrelated? My listeners are very abstract. They'll enjoy anything.
Well, one thing, just to close out, one thing that I would share is just you know, Deb Dana's work is super, super helpful. And if people, you know, want to know more or want like more practical kind of like exercise, et cetera, I mean, I personally think Deb Dana's book, it's called Polyvagal Exercises for Safety and Connection, is just excellent and filled with concrete advice along with an explanation, you know, with explanations of how exactly these exercises can, you know, help move out of states of kind of either shut down or fight flight and more into safety, and co-regulation being one of them. But yeah,
I appreciate that. Does anybody else have any resources they want to share, like books or websites or anything like that? This is a good
Danny, time. Can I just ask, is that a workbook, the one you were just mentioning?
It's not a workbook. She inserted just like, you know, like a section with the exercises kind of summarized at the end, but it's not really structured like a workbook with places where you can write and stuff like that.
Any other closing thoughts from Alexis or Alexis?
I don't, I don't have another book to mention right now. But I think just to go back to the really simple essence of the idea of co-regulation, I think I would want to close my own input to this episode by saying that, I think my greatest lessons on co-regulation have come from having kids and being able to train as a somatic experiencing practitioner while they've still been fairly young and still crawling into my lap, and learning sort of viscerally feeling their regulation and then seeing how as they're co-regulating with me. We've spoken several times today about how much children need co-regulation, but recognizing how as a parent, it really is, there's really a co in co-regulation. I also feel so regulated. And when it's really just like a bodily experience, I'm holding them. We're leaning together on the couch, we're cuddling. Just really taking the idea of, to me, co-regulation, that's at its essence. And that's something that I've really appreciated being able to do simultaneously with also learning a lot about the somatic experience.
Really beautiful. That's my experience too, by the way. Thank you for that. Lori, anything you would like to close us with?
I guess just overall, I've really, really enjoyed the conversation. It's been personally rewarding and I love connecting with all of you, and I hope it's been helpful for the listeners. I guess the last piece that I did want to comment on is I think culturally we live in a society, a Western culture, that really places a high value on individualism and self-regulation, and just reminding everyone that the co-regulation precedes self-regulation. And so feeling safe with others, feeling, you know, being able to be in a place where you can snuggle with your child, even be with a soft, cuddly pet, or go out and even laugh with a neighbor next door, especially during COVID. I mean, all of this is essential. It's essential for our survival. And so we're wired to connect.
Beautifully put, really beautifully put. I'd ask you all to unmute just to say goodbye to everybody listening. Thank you for being here. This is a wonderful discussion.
Thank you. I love talking with you guys. It always flies by.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, y'all.
For any information on the therapists in this episode, please take a look at the episode details where you will find a link to each of their names. These people are beautiful. I've come to know them for many years of practicing with them and being in supervision group with them and doing this podcast now, these episodes with them. And I learn so much from them every time, and I feel so grateful to have them as colleagues and friends. And I feel especially grateful that they are generous and vulnerable enough as therapists to go public with their opinions and beliefs and vulnerabilities. It's very rare. And so I thank them, and I thank you for listening. Well, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. My question for you is, where do you feel the episode? Take a breath and just notice, what's your body doing right now? Sit with it. Let it speak to you. And let whatever comes up, come up. And your only job is to listen. For all the wisdom you need is right inside of you. For more information on my work, including my online courses and healing circles, please visit holisticlifenavigation.com. You can also follow me on Instagram and Facebook, where I share weekly philosophies and resources to help you release stress and trauma from your body so that you can live a happier life. Thank you so much for joining me. I'll see you next time.